Okay, I think we are ready to start again. We have in front of us a couple of papers on disclosures around offsetting of financial assets and liabilities. Christian, can I invite you to lead us through the papers?
I think Barbara will be
doing it. Oh, Barbara, I'm sorry.
All right.
It's okay. Good afternoon, everyone. We're looking at Agenda Papers 3 and Memos 16 series. So these papers discuss recommended changes to the proposed disclosures that we had put in the exposure draft for offsetting financial assets and financial liabilities. Agenda Paper 3, or Memo 16, gives a background for why we've come back with these papers. It also discusses some general feedback we received from the ED that we think we have addressed in the disclosures. Agenda Paper 3A, Memo 16A, will discuss the scope of the disclosures, and then 3B, 16B, will give some disclosure alternatives that we've proposed. So if you could please turn to Agenda Paper 3, Memo 16. This paper discusses the background that we have given for the revised disclosures that we're recommending. So these are revisions to the disclosures that were originally in the exposure draft. And just to back up a little bit and give you some background again, last month in June, the boards discussed some different alternatives for the disclosure approaches that we could have. Sorry, we discussed alternatives for offsetting approaches, offsetting on the statement of financial position, based on some feedback we received on the exposure draft. So during that meeting, we discussed three alternatives for offsetting. We discussed alternative one, which was an approach based on an unconditional right and the intention to net settle or simultaneously settle. Alternative one was very similar to the approach we had in the exposure draft with some modifications. We discussed alternative two, which is based on the currently legal enforceable right, as well as the intention to net settle or simultaneously settle. That was similar to what we have today under IFRS, IS 32, offsetting requirements. We also discussed alternative three, which was giving an exception to the offsetting criteria. The exception would be for derivative contracts that were entered into under master netting agreements, and there would have been netting allowed for those contracts, as well as netting of cash collateral. So that exception would be similar to the exception that there is under U.S. GAAP today, which was formerly FIN 39. And, alternative E also had a slight derivation, which would also have given, alternative 3A would have given an exception for collateralized derivatives with daily variation margin. The boards voted on those alternatives. The ISB voted on the first alternative, alternative 1. The FASB voted on alternative 3, but for the exception. And based on that, the boards discussed how to move forward. We discussed also that based on feedback we received on the ED, users were unanimous that regardless of what was shown on the statement of financial position, they wanted both gross and net information. And so we discussed that we would move forward with converged disclosures that would provide users with the information they needed. So based on these discussions, now we've come to you with these papers. This paper discusses that background. It also discusses a few items that we're not bringing to the boards for analysis because we think our proposed disclosures cover those items. So the items that are in Agenda Paper 3 that we're not asking for specific analysis on are the level of disaggregation of the proposed disclosures, what should we show disclosure by class of financial instrument, whether we should include collateral and all kinds of collateral, non-cash collateral, whether we're duplicating existing disclosure requirements and our existing standards, whether we should be including portfolio level adjustments in the disclosures, what level of granularity should we include in the disclosure? So these issues are not separately analyzed in another paper because, again, we think we address these issues in Agenda Paper 16A, 3A, 16B, 3B. So before I move forward with the other agenda papers, are there any questions on that basic background?
Guys. Hold on.
Are you going to propose to the board that we consider disclosures about concentrations of counterparty exposure?
In the alternative that we recommend in 3B, we'll be recommending the boards give an option actually to operationalize the disclosures because we'll talk about in 3B. So yes, in a way, although it won't be a requirement. Not to the extent that we're asking for collateral, no. It's more of a geographic concentration.
Any other questions, comments? If not, I think we can move on to agenda paper 3A.
Okay, so agenda paper 3A, 16A. As I mentioned, this will discuss this discusses the scope of our revised disclosures. This is based on feedback we've received, as well as decisions that the boards made in the June meeting, 2011 meeting. So moving back a little bit, in May 2001, we discussed the feedback we received on the exposure draft. That includes the users' views on the proposed disclosures. And also, we've handed out a copy of the original proposed disclosures that are in the ED in case you want to refer to those so you can see some of these items that I'm referring to. So the exposure draft extended the disclosure requirements, the offsetting disclosure requirements, to all entities and for all financial instruments. We also required disclosure if an entity had financial instruments and related collateral, financial collateral, even if the entity didn't have any offsetting agreements or met the offsetting requirements. So the feedback received from users on the proposed disclosures were that they supported the proposed disclosures. They thought the disclosures met their needs. They did have some flexibility in what was presented, again, as long as gross and net information was presented. But preparers questioned the operationality of the disclosures that we are proposing. They questioned the scope and the cost benefit of some of these, of some of the disclosures because of the needs of users. So some of the things that the preparers asked about were whether it was necessary that we ask for this detailed information for all financial instruments. For example, do we need to ask for this information for accounts receivable? Do we need to ask for this information for deposits on with financial institutions? Was this really what users were asking for, or could we just ask for this information or require this information for derivatives, repurchase agreements, types of agreements that are entered into under master netting arrangements? Preparers also asked whether financial instruments with collateral needed to be included in the disclosures if there was no offsetting or they weren't under master netting agreements, because we do already have collateral requirements in our other financial instrument disclosures, both under U.S. GAAP and IFRS. Another question that came up was whether non-cash collateral should be included in the disclosure requirements or whether we were just focusing on financial instrument disclosure. They mention this because we talk about how these disclosures focusing on how an entity manages its credit risk, and some of these entities are saying, well, if you want us to include accounts receivable in these disclosures, then we want to also include non-cash collateral that we're, because that's how we might be managing our credit risk for some of these items. So depending on what your scope is, we want to know if we can have non-cash collateral, or sorry, non-financial instrument collateral. We, and again, their argument is, if there's no right of set-off, they think there's sufficient collateral already included in the disclosure requirements today. If we require them to put all the financial instruments in these disclosures and all types of instruments, even if they're not under master netting arrangements, they'd have to go through and reexamine all their contracts, and they think that the cost to them will outweigh the benefits for these disclosures. So based on the feedback we've received and their discussions with users and the decisions that the board have taken in the last meeting, the staff believes that the disclosure should focus on providing information that enables users to understand the effects of rights of set-off that an entity has on that entity's financial position. It should provide users with gross and net amounts to enhance comparability between IFRS and U.S. GAAP. The staff also believe that if an entity already has collateral and no set-off arrangements, no master netting arrangements, then the disclosures we have today already provide that information, so we shouldn't have to require them to include those disclosures again in the offsetting requirements. We also think that the offsetting most materially impacts derivative instruments, repos, and similar arrangements, so we think the scope should be limited to instruments that are under master netting agreements or similar arrangements, because this will provide users with the information they need to look at these types of instruments to compare U.S. GAAP and IFRS, and this will also reduce the burden to preparers. So the staff recommendation is in paragraph 25 to paper 3A, 16A. We recommend that the boards retain the disclosure objectives that we have proposed in the ED originally. Again, that we an entity disclose information about rights of set-off and related arrangements, such as collateral, when they're associated with the entity's financial assets and liabilities that enable users to understand the effects of those rights and arrangements on the entity's financial position. We would recommend that the boards modify the scope such that they only apply, these requirements only apply to instruments under enforceable master netting arrangements or similar types of arrangements. So this would generally be derivatives, repurchase agreements, securities lending agreements, but not limited to those. And I would ask the boards clarify that an entity would not have to provide the required disclosures or is not required to provide the disclosures if they don't have any qualifying assets or liabilities subject to rights of set off at the reporting date. So we would ask if the boards agree with our recommendation. If not, why not? And what would you recommend?
So later this afternoon, we're going to be presented this report on losing the excess baggage, and here we have an opportunity to prevent some excess baggage, if I understand.
You said that earlier.
Yes. Obviously, we cannot tell this group that we have added on quite a bit today before their recommendations. Anyway, who wants to comment? Tom?
I have two questions. In regards to the narrowing of the scope, what rights of assets are ignored by this scope requirement? And secondly, I'd like clarification from the FASB staff. It does not appear in U.S. GAAP that you have the quantitative amounts of collateral required except for derivatives and repurchase agreements and securities lending transactions. So the view, at least my reading of it, because in the credit risk disclosures, all you have is a requirement to talk about the qualitatively about having collateral requirements, no quantitative requirements. So I'm trying to understand the view that we have collateral elsewhere, quantitative amounts of collateral for all instruments outside the scope. So I'd like further insight into that issue, or am I misunderstanding my reading of GAAP?
Barbara, you first or FASB first?
I think I'll go for the first one. The idea is that we should be able to capture all the major types of financial instruments that are subject to rights of offset. And it tends to be derivatives, repos, reverse repos, and security lending arrangements. And typically, these arrangements are documented under a master netting agreement or a similar structure. And we think that's where the major difference between U.S. GAAP and IFRS, where we might land this week. That is where we have the differences, and hence maybe we should be focusing on those areas. There will also be a lot of offsetting going on in other M&A type of instruments, but they will not be as significant as the derivatives and the rest of them.
So there are some rights of offset in financial instruments that will not be reported if we narrow the scope.
That is correct, yeah.
FASB staff?
Yes, Tom, I would just say that in the Appendix A, Topic 860 is not limited to, it doesn't limit collateral requirements, disclosure requirements to derivatives. Topic 860 is broader than that, so if you look at your Appendix A, it's 860.30.50-1A, and then B of that, that's something that would be to consider, that you'd need to consider. But then also the broader point was that this is a project on offsetting and presentation. So to the extent that you have rights of offset, that's where we think that this project should be improving disclosures.
Ali, what is the scope of Topic 860? That's what I was trying to figure out, because 3051A starts off with only talking about securities lending transactions and repurchase agreements. Is that 1A limited to that set of instruments, or the full, what is the scope of this disclosure? You can't tell.
That's how it's presented in the codification, but based on the way that I read it and the sequencing, A is a standalone policy disclosure requirement for those particular instruments. B is standalone. It's not a subset of A.
In Topic 860, scope is all financial instruments?
That's right. Right. That's right. Recognized financial assets, yes.
That's what I'm trying to figure out. Is it just dealing with those that are transferred, or is it all financial instruments?
It's all recognized. all recognized financial assets.
All right. Thank you.
Any other? Diego?
Bob, a very simple question. In paragraph 25, you have three recommendations. And the last one, C, is it necessary?
It's necessary. Well, the staff think it's necessary because the ED required either if you had a right of set off or if you had collateral that you needed to put provide these disclosure requirements. But we think when we go back and we look at our requirements for collateral today, if you don't have a right of set off, then we think our collateral disclosure requirements already meet that criteria. So we're asking the board clarify that we can change that requirement to such that only if you have both should you be required to provide these, not if you have one or the other, because in the ED it would be one or the other.
It doesn't have to be written that way in a final standard, because
right.
You could write it in the positive as to what you want the disclosures to refer to. I think what Barbara's saying is, though, you made a decision in the ED that certain things had to be included, so we want to ask you whether those things still need to be included here. And if you say no, then we'll figure out how to write it in the right positive way.
Any other comments? So are we ready to answer the question of the staff to the proposal to limit the extent of disclosure as proposed in paragraph 25? Anyone disagrees? No? Okay.
Okay.
Excuse me?
I disagree.
You disagree to
that? Yes. I'd rather have, if it's a material right of offset for all financial instruments, that it get into the table, but not I may be the only one.
It's okay.
I think you are the only one, Tom.
So for the staff in Norwalk, Tom disagreed to B. 25B.
Okay.
Yes, did you understand?
Norwalk, I think so.
Okay, next paper.
Okay, so Holly?
Yeah.
She's waving hello. Okay, so please turn to agenda paper 3B, 16B. This paper provides the disclosure alternatives that the staff has identified based on the board's decisions that were made in June, as well as feedback that we've received. Again, that users would like to have both gross and net information, as well as to understand the differences between IFRS and US GAAP. Offsetting, we've identified two alternatives for disclosure requirements. We have alternative A, which would be a reconciliation of the amount an entity has on their statement of financial position, which would be net based on whatever the requirements are for netting under those standards, and they would have a gross amount, so they would have the net and the gross amount in a table. Alternative B would require disclosure of gross amounts that were presented net in the statement of financial position, as well as any other amounts that could be offset in the event of default, insolvency, bankruptcy, and that would include non-cash and cash financial collateral. So if we go, we can look at the alternatives. We have provided some example tables that might give the board a better idea. So if you look at paragraph 11, you can see alternative A, and we have recommended that would be divided out between these types of large types of financial instruments that have perhaps different types of offsetting, so derivatives, repurchase agreements, and other types of agreements, and then other instruments. So this alternative would show the gross amounts of these instruments, these recognized financial assets and liabilities, the amounts that are offset in the statement of financial position, so the amounts that are being net, as well as then the net amount. So this gives users information that they're asking for on gross and net amounts. However, it may not provide them all the information they need to compare amounts that are net under US GAAP and IFRS. So alternative B, if you look at the table in paragraph 22, would disclose information by gross amounts. It would show the amounts that are offset under the relative accounting standards, IFRS and US GAAP. So it would get to the amounts that are in the statement of financial position, but then it would also show the amounts that are available to be offset in the event of bankruptcy or default if they're not already offset in the statement of financial position. So these would also include non-cash collateral financial collateral that may be received or pledged that has not been offset, as well as perhaps amounts that are not allowed to be offset under IFRS but may be offset under U.S. GAAP. So the net exposure amount would get to an amount that's a comparable net exposure amount for IFRS and U.S. GAAP preparers, and it's showing a, quote, credit exposure with all types of amounts that an entity is able to offset in the statement of financial position, or sorry, based on their agreements they have, whether or not they're offset in the statement of financial position. This would give users then the gross amounts, the amounts they're able to offset, as well as this net credit exposure. Now, to address Pat's question before, we also had some feedback from preparers and some users. I mean, minority of users also said they were interested in counterparty concentration. Preparers said that often if they are not providing this net credit exposure on the statement of financial position, it's hard for them to break out this say, collateral and other types of netting arrangements by type of financial instrument. So they asked if they could provide some of this information by counterparty, not naming the counterparty, but by counterparty, and that, because that's how they manage their credit risk, and then other information based on a reconciliation to the statement of financial position. To show an example of what I'm referring to, if you look at paragraph 23, this is the alternative or the option that we're asking the boards to. Both of these tables are included in alternative B. So this second group of tables under paragraph 23 would be another way of showing the requirements in alternative B. And this would show the gross amounts of financial by type of financial asset or liability. It would show the gross amounts, the amounts that are being net in the statement of financial position, then the amount in the financial position. It would also show a second table that shows the net amount by counterparty, significant counterparty, individually but not named. Then it would be the amounts that an entity is able to offset under master netting or other arrangements that they can't already offset in the statement of financial position, as well as collateral. This is all managed by counterparty. So this would address preparers' operationality concerns, but users would also be getting the information they wanted. So this alternative, the staff believes, would give users the information they need for net and gross. It would provide comparable information for IFRS and U.S. GAAP preparers, and it would also provide some flexibility to preparers if they don't manage, say, their collateral or credit arrangements by class of financial instrument. They could show it by counterparty. So this is the recommendation that the staff is making to the boards, and we would ask the question if the boards agree with our recommendation in alternative B. I see Pat.
The good thing I would say is if, in fact, we're hearing, and this was confirmed at one of the roundtables that I attended, that the way this activity is managed is by counterparty, then it seems more logical to require that disclosure and to make it optional if you also want to supplement that by financial instrument. Because the whole purpose, or one of the principal purposes of this project, is to convey information about credit risk. Not the only, okay, liquidity and market risk are clearly there, but this is a very clearly significant purpose of this project. The other thing that's been confirmed in more than one session, whether it be a roundtable or meetings with representatives of ISDA, the legal community that advises the banking community, is that the amount of exposure in the derivatives market is concentrated among, you know, a handful, maybe 15 different major international banks. So when you look at the trillions of dollars of derivative assets and liabilities reported, whether it be in an international or U.S. financial institution, it's heavily concentrated. So this provides very good information about the level of overall enterprise risk as well as systemic risk to the international banking system, in my opinion, when you look at the top 15 or 20 financial institutions.
Do the staff want to comment on this?
Based on the outreach, I wouldn't disagree with what you're saying. I mean, based on the outreach we performed, users did not necessarily have a preference, I would say. Some users preferred by class of financial instrument because they wanted to know, especially they wanted to know the level of fair value, level 1, 2, or 3, so they understood how the entity was managing the collateral. Others thought by counterparty was better, but there wasn't as many that preferred by counterparty. Others were indifferent as long as they were getting some gross and net and collateral information. So that was the general feedback we've received.
Two preparers I know said it wouldn't be any difficulty in making this information available?
Were those
would be or would not?
Would not be.
I think it is fair to say that preparers in general will prefer a counterparty approach. Users were indifferent between the way we set it out. The first three columns, they will prefer to see that by class of financial instrument, especially splitting that between trades with central counterparties and trades on the OTC market, because they take a different view when it comes to these instruments. Well, but from that point, they want to buy a counterparty.
In theory, a counterparty could be an OTC exchange transaction.
Yeah.
In theory.
Amaru?
Just a question, actually, because we are requiring them to, this is a requirement, this is not optional. And the option that Pat is suggesting, banks and anyone can provide anyway. We are not preventing them from providing any type of additional information.
But they won't.
Well, it pretty much depends on the security regulator. Pretty much depends on the market influence on that. There is somewhat market discipline somewhere. There are lots of literature that indicates that market can exert some discipline. So I don't think it's necessary to put in an accounting standard an optional disclosure. Doesn't make sense for me. Or either we require or we don't require.
These are examples of ways that this information could be provided. This is the way the staff are saying this is the information that should be provided, and these are examples of how a preparer could provide it, if the boards agree with that.
But Barbara, just a clarification. In paragraph 21, it does say by major type of financial instrument and or by counterparty. So just to be clear, the staff is saying or?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
You know, I don't want to get into all the things that these guys are talking. I just want to go back to the simple table that is there in paragraph 22 in order for us to decide between the two. And I look at the paragraph 26, and I just have to ask a question. The way I looked at it, maybe I kind of broken into columns, right? The column D and F are predominantly, or especially D, column D in the paragraph 22 is predominantly, or for the most part, would be IFRS users would be, IFRS preparers would be putting amounts in that column. Is that an accurate statement or no?
So if you look at paragraph 22 we're referring to, right?
And column B.
Column B would be amounts.
D as in delta.
Oh, sorry, D.
As in delta.
Well, you would assume that there would be more information in that column for IFRS preparers,
okay.
Yes.
Now, let me ask you all a question. This is what something threw me off in para 26. The last sentence, it could be the auditor speak, you know, but I want to understand if I capture all the instruments in one or the other columns, why would the net credit exposure between IFRS preparers and U.S. GAAP preparers be different? Because, however, this alternative may not necessarily reconcile U.S. GAAP and IFRS amounts. Are you talking about amounts on the balance sheet, or are you talking about credit exposure? I'm slightly confused. Will the net credit exposure be the same under both the preparers? If I take Christian is being very, very carefully nodding his head.
We'll see if Christian can. I'll speak, and then Christian can correct me. But the the amounts. this wouldn't reconcile IFRS and U.S. GAAP amounts on the statement of financial position. So it wouldn't reconcile amounts that are being offset.
Is it because of the recognition criteria?
It's because we have different criteria for offsetting on the statement of financial position. But this is the reason the staff are recommending this alternative instead of alternative A, because then you could get to a net, quote, credit exposure, regardless of whether that exposure is based on your statement of financial position netting or other information or other arrangements you've entered into, such as collateral arrangements or other types of, say, conditional arrangements that you can't net on the statement of financial position.
It's a simple question.
So maybe this is worded poorly, this paragraph.
I think the idea is that somehow the view that we need to be able to walk from one gap to the other. And what we're saying is that you'll not be able to do that under each of these approaches. You'll not be able to walk from US GAAP to IFRS or from IFRS to US GAAP.
but rather we're giving you information that will help you as a user to be able to compare the two entities. For instance, you have the gross amount and you have the net credit exposure. You'll not be able to restate an IFRS preparer's balance sheet to be as if it prepared under US GAAP. That's what we're saying. So you'll not be able to reconcile from IFRS to US GAAP, but you have information to be able to compare entities preparing accounts under different accounting guidance.
Yeah, your question is, are columns A
and F the same whether you're following IFRS or US GAAP? Columns A and F are the same, so the only issue is where do you draw the line between the two? And because I got a little concerned, Barbara, when you said that it, you know, D for IFRS should be greater.
No, I was answering PK's question, is that we would assume it would be greater, the amounts.
Would be greater, well, okay.
So A and F will be the same for both. I didn't get this last sentence in 26 kind of threw me off. That's what I was saying.
And can I just clarify, Leslie, you had asked before about in paragraph 21, the and or?
Yep.
That and or only relates to 16D, our recommendation being amounts that could be offset conditionally that are not already offset in the statement of financial position. We're not, those staff in either of these tables in alternative B would still say the board should require the gross and net amounts that are for the statement of financial position to be, we would still say you should require by financial instrument the gross amounts offset, and then amounts that are on the statement of financial position. Where the and or comes is the other amounts that are not on the statement of financial position.
Yeah.
Because users still want to reconcile gross to the financial statement of financial position.
But so can you just give me a practical application of that then? Because so it's the effects of rights of set off that are not taken effect in the financials. So that wouldn't that primarily be derivatives or repos under IFRS?
Yes.
And so we're saying, rather than say, here are my derivatives that are subject to these agreements and not net, I have exposure of $1 trillion to counterparty A.
Yes, because some of these
say what it is.
It's not that they don't want to say what it is. It's that they don't necessarily manage these arrangements. And it may not only be IFRS preparers, but this has come up a lot with IFRS preparers. Because they don't offset on the statement of financial position under conditional netting arrangements, they often manage the collateral or offset amounts they can offset by counterparty versus by type, by derivative, repo, or other type.
But it's not the way it would be presented by a U.S. preparer. In other words, if we're trying to provide comparable information, the net amount for the U.S. preparer would be by asset type or liability type, not by counterparty. Do you know what I mean?
No, I think generally, master letting agreements or offsetting will be by counterparty.
Yes.
Because it rises between you and the counterparty. So the amounts you offset, and whether you're showing the amounts by class of financial instrument or not, the amount you've offset will be based on a right you have against the counterparty. Under column B, you have more offsetting. We expect more offsetting under US GAAP than IFRS. We expect, it might not necessarily be the case, but we expect more offsetting for US GAAP than IFRS. On the other hand, in column D, is it E?
She's talking about these two.
You have more in the other column for IFRS than US GAAP. We expect, it might not be the case. The idea is that overall, everything is by counterparty basis. But users are saying that they also want to see some information based on class of financial instruments. And we think to the extent that the entity can provide that, it should be provided. And the rest that they cannot provide by class of financial instrument should be done by counterparty.
Let me put it this way. I'm sorry to belabor the point. If an entity does none of this to mitigate their credit risk, they're going to be presenting loans, derivatives, repos, et cetera, and there's no information about counterparty in the financial statements other than we happen to have a requirement that's I'll leave off the table. But now we're saying if you have taken steps to mitigate it, but it doesn't qualify for netting, instead of presenting the gross amounts and the net amounts for the types of assets and liabilities, turn it on its access and provide counterparty information. That's my struggle.
No, the gross and net amounts on the statement of financial position would be by type of financial asset. But then the net further netting that you could have under arrangements that were not on the statement of financial position. So if you want to go to, say, an IFRS preparer that may have derivatives under master netting agreement, if you look at paragraph 23, these two tables, they may have some derivatives, say, that meet the offsetting criteria on the statement of financial position. So they'll have a gross amount in the derivatives. They'll have an amount that's offset. They'll have a net amount. Yeah. Then if you go to the table below that, they may have other derivatives that are not meeting the criteria for offsetting. So they'll put, but to tie to the financial position, you'll put these amounts in those columns by counterparty and then show the amounts that are further mitigated by other types of arrangements, such as master netting arrangements, in the second table. But you still have to show the gross and any netting by type of financial instrument if it's on the statement of financial position. I know this is not 100% clear. I mean, to be honest, this came up from a operational standpoint for some preparers that did not have information that wasn't offset on the financial position by type of financial instrument.
Barbara, if you just have some follow-up
question. Okay. Would, if you applied this model to IFRS and a U.S. GAAP company, would counterparty A, in your example, have a different dollar amount? Or would it likely have a different dollar amount? When you get down to your last schedule, not a schedule number, but counterparty A would likely have a different dollar amount shown because you're building this, if I understand this correctly, you're building this off of the net presented in the financial statements. Is that correct?
Well, we didn't put a total at the end, but if you put a total column at the end.
Well, just following your schedule, you got that little I, and then 2i, that equals 3i. 3i carries over the total, whatever is in 3i, is going to be the total in your net amount of financial assets by counterparty. Is that correct?
That's right.
Right. And since that ties to what's in your balance sheet, you could run the same transactions through two different accountings, IFRS is a GAAP, and you would end up at a different number for A, for counterparty A.
For the first
total
column.
Wouldn't.
For the first column, yes, you'll have a different number.
Okay. So why would you not do this last column, or you mean this last counterparty, by the column F on the previous page? So at least you'd get, when you get to counterparty, you'd have counterparty information comparable between two companies.
Well, we need to have a total column. Is that what you're asking? Because we need to have a starting point that the users can tie back to the financial statements.
You've got a good starting point.
So
I agree with column A.
Start with the net amount.
You have column A and column F. Those are your beginning and ending points, and they're the same for both preparers.
Yes.
Okay. What's different is that column C, somewhere in between, but that's what you're using. Column C is driving your counterparty information. Would it be better to use column F to drive your counterparty information?
Because this second table is trying to get back to this, also to the statement of financial position. So that is why we started with the net amounts, first by type of instrument and then by counterparty.
I understand.
So does that answer your question? That's why we wouldn't.
Yeah, I'm questioning the. I'm thinking that it's more column. I'm thinking column F for counterparty risk is more important than column C.
Well, if I'm understanding this.
But Barbara, you didn't complete the disclosure.
Oh, yes.
If there's on page 7, you need a column F in the second half table.
It was put a total column.
Yes, you missed it, right?
Yes, that's correct.
But you'd also lose information if you followed your set.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go through the order. You wanted to ask?
Touch on the point Leslie made. Even on the face of the balance sheet, even though you're showing some of these positions by class or financial instrument, the netting that you do before you get to those numbers are on counterparty basis. And so the information on the face of the balance sheet is a mixture of counterparty and class of financial instrument. And hence, we're just replicating the same thing in the notes.
I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
I think I was struggling with something totally different. We are talking here about disclosure to for financial instruments. Are we focusing a bit too much on financial institutions disclosing that compared to someone else who's got potentially, for whatever reason, a large part of financial instruments? So my question would be something totally different. Have we made sure that also other preparers have had a look at that so that they're not getting caught cold when we are publishing something and say, well, this is great for financial institutions, but not for all the others?
Well,
yes, Barbara?
When we talk to preparers, we talk to a variety. Obviously, we did talk to a lot of financial institutions. We talked to other preparers. We talked to them about the type of disclosures that were operational, the type of disclosure made sense based on the managing of the credit risk. Those that have large derivative or other types of activities did not have a problem with these types of disclosures, if that helps. But then if you go to the other instruments that we were talking about, like receivables and things like that, it was where the burden came in.
Tom.
You brought something up about exchanges or clearinghouses versus OTC contracts. Will we be differentiating within these disclosures instruments by those two categories? Because the nature of the credit risk is vastly different in those two settings.
Okay. We had originally proposed that. There was a lot of pushback based on the burden and the operationality. There was differing views from users about whether or not they needed that level of detail. Some did and some didn't. So, no, we did not recommend that.
Let's go back to 25B. Is 25B written well enough that clearinghouses and exchanges are contemplated in the scoping? Because when it says master netting agreements or similar arrangement, it feels like that's OTC contracts. And it doesn't really get into exchanges or derivatives or these instruments that are on clearinghouses or exchanges.
So
even if we don't break it out, I think the derivatives that are on clearinghouses and exchanges should be in these disclosures.
And the intention of the staff is that those would be included, which is why one of the reasons we said similar arrangements would include mass, because when you clear through an exchange, you will often have a master type netting arrangement with the exchange, because that's how they're, depending on how they're clearing, if they're clearing through batch, depends on how they're clearing. But if there's a clearing,
if you don't have a master netting agreement with the exchange, but they're still clearing and there's some offsetting, are we getting those derivatives and other items within this disclosure?
In the disclosure.
So the scope should be written well enough to encompass, I think, all derivatives in the presentation.
But how would they be getting offsetting if they didn't have that type of arrangement?
Well, I know they're getting offsetting. I'm worried that when you write 25B, it reads like it's only those that are subject to contracts, not master netting type contracts, rather than agreements with an exchange that might not really be viewed to be a master netting contract.
But meet the criteria.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. We'll make sure that we...
Russ.
Thank you. Question to staff and then question to Pat. Paragraph 23 says counterparties would not be identified by name. So my question is, why is that? And then Pat, what would you do with information that had an example that said counterparty A, counterparty B, counterparty C?
That's a good question. That's a good question.
We wouldn't require by name because there are many different I think some regions may not allow that by name. Others, companies don't want to disclose it by name because of confidentiality reasons, business confidentiality reasons. So we didn't think that we should be requiring that by name.
Yeah, I think Russ's question though is what's the utility of doing it by counterparty A, B, C without having a name there? So,
well, I think.
Well, you can see concentration.
Maybe Pat can answer that, but what the users told us is that they do have the opportunity to ask management who those counterparties are. If they know, if they're listed, they can ask management for who the counterparties are. So that's what they said.
They said
they're
all
going to ask. Why not put the name down?
Yeah, I don't think you can.
The principal reason is concentration of credit risk.
Okay, that's the obvious answer, I think. So to the extent that you know, let's say you're looking at a major U.S. bank and they've got over $1 trillion of derivative assets. If you see they're concentrated 80%, in five entities, you know there's a great deal of counterparty credit risk. And
you're probably going to be looking at the balance sheets of those other large institutions. And you're going to probably be asking questions without necessarily knowing who those entities are. You're probably going to ask questions about controls around that counterparty credit risk. So it deepens your knowledge about how management is dealing with this very, very important risk. As to what, you know, whether or not you know it's J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Deutsche Bank, is almost, to some degree, it's almost irrelevant because we know it's concentrated in these 15 names.
Stephen.
Well, just on that, I've got another point. Why is concentration of credit risk not dealt with in IFRS 7? Is it? So what additional information are we getting?
Well, it's detailed.
I think we're not necessarily providing information about concentration of risk. That's not the core objective. The objective is to provide information about the effects of the rise of set of that an entity has. That information can be cut in different ways. You can do it by class of financial instrument, or you can do it by counterparty. Some prefer to see it by counterparty, some prefer to see it by class of financial instrument. So that's not the core objective here, but to the extent that if we cut in a particular way, it provides more information than the other, then it might be a more preferable way to move forward.
Okay, that wasn't the thing I was going to talk about, actually. I wanted to talk about the columns rather than the rows. And, Fal, we get common numbers with columns A and F and the gross and the net exposure, but we get nothing else. So it means that it's impossible to adjust a U.S. GAAP balance sheet onto an IFRS basis or an IFRS balance sheet onto your U.S. GAAP basis. So my question is, why can't we do that? Why can't we have column B as amount set off under IFRS approach, column C IFRS balance sheet, column D additional amounts offset under US GAAP approach, column F, E, whichever it is, US balance sheet?
Sorry, Daryl wants to answer that question.
In essence, then you're asking banks to require the full requirements of FASB requirements as well as the full requirements of
IFRS. Well, we haven't got the same model, so in order to reconcile, isn't that what we have to do?
Yeah, the whole goal here is to be able to get it.
Well,
we proposed it in the ED.
The reason why we didn't propose that is that number one, you ask an entity to apply two different GAAPs, and you're putting more burden on them. That's the first one. The second one is that, although on the face of it, it might appear that we only have a difference when it comes to derivatives, there's so many little things that one will have to take into account to arrive at the other number that the table will just go on miles and miles and miles. I can tell you about 5 different or 10 different adjustments that you have to make to get to a U.S. GAAP number and vice versa. There's a perception that, for instance, you get more derivative offsets under U.S. GAAP than IFRS. It might not be so for all instruments. And hence, there's so much more that you need to do to be able to reconcile from one number to the other. And in the end, the minor probably give you any more information better than what we provide in terms of the disclosures here. Then the other problem that you have is that the gap is moving around. U.S. GAAP might change tomorrow. And then you have to then, you know, revise your table to be able to come to the other number. It is not. And why do we always have to adjust to a particular gap? There are other gaps around the world that you might probably, Steve, you might probably want to reconcile to. So there are many problems with that approach. So we did not recommend that.
Steve, so you know, we did start trying to do a table with an alternative like that, and we can't. That's how we found that these things were just it just wasn't a reasonable recommendation.
Sounds pretty convincing to me.
Hi, follow up question on the counterparty. If I'm looking at sequential financials and I've got counterparty A, quarter one versus quarter two, and the amounts change, it could change because one of two reasons. We change the risk between the two counterparties, or there's a reverse and change in order in the counterparties. Has anyone raised the issue of potential unintended consequences of drawing wrong conclusions? Because if counterparty A were exactly the same party and the number dropped or went up, you could have different conclusions drawn, but then you could say, oh, it's always the same party, I'm guessing, and you see the number change, but it could have been just because simply there's a party changing here. And this is going to be maybe unusual, but I actually think this is too much information. That could be misconstrued. And, you know, the way I would modify this is maybe group them the top two or three. To Pat's comment earlier, there may be 15 to 19 or whatever the number was exactly, maybe the largest five, the next five, and the five after that. I'm a little concerned that this granularity will create a guessing game, and I can see traders starting to throw trades in at the end of a quarter to see where they rank. As a counterparty on the other side, I see some games being played here. So I put that as something to think about. I don't have an answer for you, but other than to maybe group by groups of five.
Or to talk about, I'm sorry, for example, right now with our disclosure requirement for concentrations of credit risk, people satisfy that by saying things like, our lending business is concentrated in this type of counterparty. And so for this, you could say something like, our derivative business primarily involves the top five dealers and, you know, et cetera, without getting into more specifics.
Can I? There are probably a couple of points I want to make on this one. The first one is, I think this is an alternative that you can choose to do or choose not to do. You can do the other way or this. So if you feel that you're very sensitive about your counterparty information, you're probably taking the other choice. Was the first thing. The second thing is, I guess we're assuming comparatives here.
Yeah.
So if they're comparatives, you'd actually be able to track that counterparty A has now become counterparty B because the comparatives would move with the... When you wouldn't say counterparty A this and it was a different counterparty that you're putting in the comparative. Absolutely.
That's right.
Yeah.
Is the second point. And the third one is in terms of ranking yourself with the opposite counterparty. I'm presuming me as a counterparty has got a fairly good idea of my exposure to UV is. So I could probably find it on the table anyway. I don't think I'd need to read it in your financials to know what my number was. I hope not, anyway. not that I disagree with the comment about less disclosure.
Okay. Where you go?
No, I fully agree to require disclosure by products, but as to comment about this, I feel some doubts, you know. The few issues behind that. First, let's assume, you know, basically through centralized clearinghouse, do we require to disclose if the net through the clearinghouse?
If they're the counterpart.
And is there any information content behind that? You know, there are two big clearinghouse, you know.
Look, I think users find it to be very useful to understand if there's one counterparty where you have a significant amount of transactions and where all your credit risk is being managed with one counterparty.
And secondly, some of us raise issues about confidentialities. And can you check? You know, of course, usefulness, I don't want to totally deny, you know, especially pets. So, you know, stress on this one. But is there any confidentiality issues there?
Without the name, just saying A, B, C, D.
No, name, of course.
We're not requiring a name.
No.
We think that is a confidentiality.
Take that information, it's A, B, C, D.
And then, what's the benefits? You know. For example, I'm so risky, counterparties, and so good guys, and you list me A, and it's B, but D. Totally different animals. You put them together. And A, for example, 20%, B, 50%. But obviously, you see nothing.
Yes, please.
No. I've seen in the financial statements of many companies that I've analyzed, in conjunction with seller financing provided with an acquisition, that when a company takes back a note and it's material, they'll disclose whom that note they have a credit arrangement with. So the issue of confidentiality, I think, has to be examined closely here. I don't know, maybe you can tell me, whether or not it's a prohibition okay, under banking regulation or federal securities laws. But I don't know that there is under U.S. GAAP, okay, or IFRS, prohibition in disclosing who your counterparties are.
Yes, there is. In many countries.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, well, but as far as I know, you know, if you do a transaction, like I said, you sell a business, you buy it with seller financing.
Okay, Amaru?
Yeah, first of all, there are in many countries legal aspects that should be considered when we are talking about counterparties. In many jurisdictions, the law forbid the bank to provide information about the counterparties, especially in the liability side. Not always in the asset side, but especially in the liability side. But there are countries that you have both, either in the asset side and the liability side. And the disclosures around those are generally in the way Leslie described it, the largest 10 or the largest 20, and leave to the market and the credit analysts to explore that more or less. And I find this I thought this discussion would be very sharp and quick, and I'm being surprised at how long does it take, because I guess it started out, what is the objective of the project? It's very strange for me, and I'm coming back to the point I made, to have a standard setting options. What do we believe is important in this project? To provide information about the netting of the instruments or the counterparty? Because I'm just giving the users a free choice. Oh, this time I'll be comfortable with the counterparty. Now I'll be comfortable with the financial assets. We either believe those two are important. I think we started this project focusing on the financial instruments, not in the counterparties. And then now we are discussing which one of those might be disclosed, because it's still an option. So,
now, is all this going to lead to a different conclusion than that the staff are suggesting?
So I think although we say you can take a very high-level approach and say, well, it doesn't matter whether by class of financial instrument or by counterparty. You aggregate all your financial instruments, the better you can offset, and everything that you can offset against it, you come to a net total amount. That is one perfect approach that you can take. But all we're saying is that within that number, you can slice that total financial instrument number in different ways to give different information, and so give the gross and the net to provide information that the project is supposed to provide. So you have three options. You can say, well, aggregate every financial instrument that you have and give us both the gross and the net. Or you can say, well, slice that number into different parts and give us the gross and the net. And if we're going to slice it, how do we slice it? That's all that we're discussing here.
Yeah. No, I agree with all your observations. I just don't agree in the way we are driving the discussion, because we are concentrating, we should disclose counterparties or we should disclose instruments. And the question I made, what do we believe is the important piece of information here? And we will require this information.
So we are going to end up doing both?
Yeah, maybe this is
Another disclosure? PK?
I'll change the topic for a second, if you guys permit me.
Get another ring.
The question I have is that maybe I don't recollect this issue in the comment letters that I've seen. I don't profess that I've seen all the comment letters. The amount that you show as collateral, and I was looking at IFRS 7 with the help of Pat McConnell, the collateral held, the cash and fair value, is a lot more granular than what IFRS 7, for example, asks you to do. Is there any reaction from the preparer community / auditing community or anybody, just to say that, because I suddenly see this and I feel that there are a lot of valuation issues that can come up. In the event of a bankruptcy, in the event of a liquidation, what is the fair value of the asset that you're going to hold, and how much is the collateral? Any flavor on that? Because when we lay it on the people, I don't want people to tomorrow complain, and I just want to make sure that we have addressed that concern.
Yeah, I think some will be reluctant, wouldn't like an approach where you aggregate all the collateral that you have, both cash and non-cash. Some see cash to be a more, well, I think most people will see cash to be a more reliable source of sort of collateral than other financial instruments. So they want the two to be separated. And those who would like to set the two into accounts can do so. But the whole point here is that we're saying that entities should, well, we're recommending to the board that entities or preparers should show the gross amount, the amount on the face of the balance sheet, and what the worst case scenario will be. The question for you is, do you want to break down that number, these numbers that I just mentioned, into subclasses? And if so, how do you want to divide that number? There are two ways you can do it. You can do it by class of financial instrument, or you can do it by counterparty. For instance, collateral, there is no way you can do, if you have a cross-product agreement, then you need to split your collateral into all the different classes of financial instrument that you have. And it's not a workable approach. So there are pros and cons on both sides. And so what we're saying is that some of the information will lend themselves to more class of financial instruments approach than counterparty approach. So you have all these instruments already on the face of the balance sheet. So you repeat that what you have on the balance sheet, and then the amounts you've all set to arrive at the amounts on the face of the balance sheet. From that point onwards, it makes more sense to do it by counterparty, because else you go into the realm of dividing the collateral between different product classes. That's all that we suggested.
Philippe. Thank you. I'm a little bit struggling to understand how this information here reconciles with, or is different from, or duplicates what we have in IFRS 7, paragraph 34, application guidance B8, which says an entity is required to disclose concentration of risk. 34 says it's according to the eyes of management. Okay, according to the management, how they manage risk. And the illustrative paragraph says how management determines concentrations, a description of the shared characteristics that identifies each concentration, e.g. counterparty, geographical area, currency or market, and the amount of risk. So let's take, I'm a bank, a French bank, I'm exposed to Greek situation. Not government bonds. I've lent money to five Greek banks. To determine, and by counterparty without giving the names, doesn't tell me much. But maybe to say my concentration of risk net of collaterals to the Greek banks by geography, by market, is much more important. So I think, as we say in IFRS 7, we should leave it to management to determine what is useful information based on the objective of providing users with information to understand the concentration of risk. So whether it is by counterparty or by market, or even by currency, maybe U.S. bank exposed to the Eurozone may wish to disclose information net of collaterals on the Eurozone. Maybe, I don't know. So I think this is a different philosophy here, or we're trying to concentrate on counterparties rather than keeping the philosophy we have very well defined in IFRS 7. And I agree with Amaro. It's a proposed standard about offsetting, not about disclosing concentration of risk.
Have you seen those disclosures?
Yeah, I think I might have to repeat what I just said again, but we're not seeking to provide necessarily concentration of risk information. All we're saying is that under this project, to be able to provide some comparison between US GAAP and IFRS, you will need to show the gross amount, the amount on the face of the balance sheet, and what the net amount will be. You have three choices when you do that. You can either aggregate all the financial instruments and show these three buckets. Or you can then break down these buckets into class of financial instruments or into counterpart or along counterparty lines. That is a choice that you have to make. So there are three ways you can show that information. Which of them provides the best or the most useful information? But you have to end in whichever way you go, you have to provide this information or else there will be no comparison or you cannot compare financial instruments as statements.
I just would leave it to IFRS 7 to determine how you do that. I think the principle is to show the net after offsetting. Then, whether you break it this way, that way, or another way, leave it to IFRS 7.
Isn't that what he's saying?
Well,
These recommendations.
That's what we are, and or all. And we're saying that for some of them, there's no way you can even do it by class of financial instrument. When you have collateral and it's a cross-product agreement, then the collateral will be called based on all the positions that you have, derivatives, securities lending, repos, reverse repos. You take the collateral based on all these three items. But on the face of the balance sheet, you don't present these three items together. You show them separately. But the collateral is called based on the net position of all these three items. And hence, you need to divide the collateral if you're going to go along that route. You need to divide the collateral by these three classes. I don't know how you're going to do it, and it's going to be a very artificial number anyway.
Philippe, just to kind of back up a minute, in the ED, we had an objective for the disclosures, which we put in 25A, paragraph 25A, where we say we want the entity to disclose information about rights of set-off and related arrangements that are associated with their financial assets and liabilities so users can understand how those rights and arrangements affect their financial position. So this is what we're trying to do in addition to the IFRS 7 disclosures that we already have. That's why we're focusing, again, like Christian was saying, on how do you break up these types of arrangements, because we think this breakout by counterparty or by financial instrument is meeting that objective that we've proposed.
Mark.
All right. I don't understand how this conversation's gotten so convoluted. The boards voted separately. The boards voted differently on the overall issue because many board members of the FASB and many users, not all, probably split half and half, said they wanted to know about net credit exposure. Net credit exposure is one of the most important things. They wanted to know about that. And so the boards split up. Now we're faced with the disclosure to try to reconcile from what's on the balance sheet to gross and to net credit exposure. Okay? Alternative A doesn't do it for me. I'm firmly in the alternative B camp. Okay? So now in alternative B, the table under paragraph 22 sets out the objective. Get both sides to gross and get both sides to net credit exposure. This whole discussion about counterparty is a red herring to me. Okay? The first three columns of 22 are the same. Okay? If you go to on page 6 or page 7, the first three columns are exactly the same to get to what's on the balance sheet. All I think the staff are recommending, and I agree with them, is if to get to net credit exposure, the company decides that the way that they do it is by figuring out their net credit exposure by line item, then disclose it by line item on page in paragraph 22. If, on the other hand, the company manages it and tracks it by counterparty, then the company has the option, not a requirement, the option to go with what's on the paragraph 23 on the bottom of page 7. It's the company's option. There's no requirement here. There's no trying to take over IFRS 7 and require it, you know, done differently here. It's just a company's option to help facilitate the conversation about how they get to net credit exposure with their users. I think it totally makes sense. I would be fully on board with the staff recommendation here because I think it gets you exactly what the two sides wanted, which was gross and net credit exposure.
Well, Mark certainly succeeded in unconfusing me.
Good.
I hope that goes for more of us.
Hal,
have you been unconfused?
I didn't think I was confused before.
Still trying to figure out what animal I am, basically. It truly is an option, correct? Okay. Because I was concerned that if B and E merge, you're all of a sudden, because of your comment earlier, if B and E merge, you're going to go back and restate a prior period to show B and E together, because that would be the only way it would be comparable. And so this transparency to tomorrow's issue is going to become very clear. After two or three mergers, you're going to know who every party is in the table. So that led me down the path of no one's ever going to disclose counterparty. And that's why I think counterparty is important, but not to have it so granular that no one does it,
to mandate it, but mandate it by two or three groups of...
Well, and counterparty will still be disclosed under IFRS 7 and under, I don't know if we have concentration of credit risk as a U.S. GAAP disclosure as well.
Not by counterparty.
Not by counterparty. Correct. Right.
But
I'm trying...
It's an option.
I'm just trying to get it to not line by line counterparty A, B, and C, because mergers will really... give you a lot of information.
So does the fact that we're recommending it be an option, how was that, does that address your concern?
I'm sorry.
the fact that we're saying it's an option, like Mark was very well put.
I think as an option,
so clear this way.
It's an option by line, you'll never get it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's an option, or excuse me, mandated by groups of counterparties. You know, groups of 2-3, top 10%, top 20%, however you want to do it. Excuse me, do it. I think would be useful, and I would get it. I don't think I'll ever get by counterparty here.
So that would be a tweak to the proposal to not leave it as an option, but to mandate. I think I heard the staff say that wouldn't make sense in many cases, right?
It would still be an option, I think, but what wouldn't be an option is how you aggregate or disaggregate your counterparties.
Yeah.
That's what Hal is saying. So he'd mandate,
okay. I would mandate
something within the option is what you would do.
Okay.
Can I ask a basic question? So I think Mark helped unconfuse me by pointing out that it seems like everybody's in agreement that the first three columns of the table in paragraph 22 are appropriate. The question is, how do you satisfy D and E? So if I have an IFRS filer who concludes they would want to provide this information in D and E by class, so they give me the numbers for derivatives, repos, et cetera, and then I have another IFRS filer, but a different filer who chooses to satisfy the requirement by counterparty, you would not be able to go in and say, here's the gross derivative exposure and here's the net on a comparable basis. Is that fair? But not by, not necessarily by the class.
But the gross amounts you would compare. The gross amounts would always be comparable.
Yep. Understood, but the net wouldn't if I present it by counterparty.
So why not do the first table by type of asset, and then replicate the same table totally by counterparty?
Well, because we had feedback, one, that this wasn't operational for a lot of entities. Another, like Christian was describing, that often they will have to break up their collateral. If they're not offsetting collateral, there could be an initial deposit amount or an independent amount. They've got to now do an arbitrary allocation of this.
You said that earlier, but I just...
Yeah. Are we ready to come to a conclusion? Which would be that we support the staff proposal?
That would be the conclusion.
As amended by Hal with the groups instead of individual? Or?
Well, I'm not sure if that was an amendment.
I would recommend that because I think I'll ultimately get more counterparty disclosures.
How would we phrase this? Let's try to be precise here.
Is this a drafting? I guess it depends on how strongly the board members feel about that. Is this a drafting issue? Or this, I mean, if this going to address
it's
users?
It's never voted on the staff recommendation.
Yes. Okay.
I would go back 4 times.
Can we have a vote on the staff proposal? Who is in favor?
ISB.
FASB. In favor?
Six.
Okay.
Who's against it?
Yes,
I would have supported it if that had been removed.
Okay. So Leslie would support if the counterparty was removed? Is that the same for Amaro, just so we understand?
I think so.
It's an option. You can.
No, I don't think so.
It's an option, yeah.
Yeah, but then you end up with a lack of comparability. That's the whole point of the disclosure.
Would you go with it if it were grouped in by quartile or something?
No.
Top 25%.
No, you still don't have your derivatives number. That's what they want.
Well, no, I was going to have that part. Just the last part would be counterparty. You want
Okay.
Yes,
go ahead.
That's it,
then. Thank you. Okay. Yes? Oh, the our guests are here, so I think we could ask them to come in, right?
Okay. Yep. Thank you. Thanks.